Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Welcome to the channel, and thanks for joining me today. I just finished talking with Jessamine Abel about her new book, The International Minimum, Creativity and Contradiction in Japan's Global Engagement, 1933 to 1964. This came out with the University of Hawaii Press in 2015. The book presents a really, really interesting and nuanced picture of the emergence and transformation of kinds of internationalism. So internationalism in various ways and that takes various shapes in Japan in the middle of the 20th century. And in order to do that, it takes us into some really interesting case studies that range from an account of Japan's engagement in and with the League of Nations, the United Nations, into successful and failed attempts to host the Olympic Games, and then finally into some really formative conferences that help us understand the ways that internationalism and regionalism were imbricated in the middle of the 20th century. So it's a really fascinating book that I think is going to be of interest not just to historians of and people who are interested in reading about modern Japan, but also anybody who's interested in modern politics, in global politics, and in kind of foreign relations and its histories as well. So with that, I will leave you to the conversation and just say thank you as ever for your support of the channel and for listening, and I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Jessamine Abel about her new book, The International Minimum. Welcome to the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, Jess, and thanks for both writing a really timely and a really fascinating book and also for making time to talk with me about it today. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Carla. I'm very happy that you actually wanted to ask me about my book.
So let's start with the big question. What brought you to the study of Japan, and why modern Japan in particular?
Well, what brought me to the study of Japan was, as probably is the case with many people, just various personal circumstances. When I was in college, my parents happened to go live in Japan for a year and brought me with them for the summer. I happened to be looking for a topic to write my senior thesis on. And this was, I'm giving away how old I am now, but the first time that the Soviet Union went to the G7 conference. And the Japanese were very upset about that circumstance because they had this outstanding territorial dispute with the Soviet Union, and it was in the news every day. I was a politics major in college and thought, okay, great, this is what I'm writing my senior thesis on. And I really enjoyed researching Japan as I enjoyed living in Japan for that summer, and went back to finish my senior year of college and ended up writing a senior thesis on Soviet Japanese American relations. And that was sort of my first step and gained interest from there. So modern Japan, because I came at it from a very contemporary angle. I initially thought maybe I will study political science in graduate school, but found when I was doing a master's in international affairs that I was really more interested in the historical angle of every topic that I looked at. So I decided to study history instead, but I really was interested in things that had happened in the fairly recent past, and so went with modern history.
Great. Thank you. So the book that we are talking about today, and I'm going to use the words of the book right now and just kind of briefly introduce it for listeners who haven't had a chance to read it. But the study, in the words of the book, traces the evolution of the internationalist worldview in Japan by examining official policy and general discourse surrounding Japan's withdrawal from the League of Nations and its admission into the United Nations, also the failed and successful attempts to host the Olympics in Tokyo, and also wartime and post-war regional conferences in Tokyo and in Bandung, Indonesia. So that's a kind of summary from the book. Now, though these moments, as you tell us early in the book, have received historical attention before, they have not really been studied together. They've been studied separately and not as part of a cohesive story. So the book brings them together into a story about 20th century international relations in Japan, and as a result, it's able to trace continuity and change over time. And by the end of the book and by the end of our conversation today, I'm sure it'll become clear why this is actually really important to do, not just just for how we understand history, but for how we understand our contemporary world and some current and future issues as well. Okay, so that is the overall, just kind of a capsule, like thumbnail sketch of the project as it stands as a book. But Jess, how did you come to this project in particular? What brought you to the issue of international relations in Japan as a focus for your study?
Well, as I mentioned, I had done master's in international affairs before applying to PhD programs, and was coming at it from an interest in international relations. And I initially wanted to research the post-war precursors or the post-war background of Japan's contemporary international relations. I was particularly interested in some of the conflicts between Japan's very strong position economically and the criticism it was getting internationally for not being internationalist enough and not really contributing enough to the international community. So looking for the background of this in the post-war period, I learned about Japan's continued participation in the League of Nations after they officially withdrew in 1933. And that kind of made me start wondering, oh, well, if there were people who were still trying to be internationalist after Japan quit the League of Nations, what happened to those people over the course of the war? And that really pulled my interest back toward the 1930s and 1940s. I discovered when I looked at that some really interesting continuities, but also changes that happened during the war that seemed to be very important for post-war foreign policy and international relations.
Right. Now, this is a project that started out as a dissertation project, right? Even if it changed. So can you talk a little bit about that for us? So in the transition or transformation from dissertation to book, were there any kind of major or notable transformations in the nature of the project?
Well, the biggest transformation is one of size. I basically wrote half of the book as my dissertation, and that was essentially the wartime period. Even though I had originally envisioned it, and I think even my dissertation title, if I can remember what it was, included a trans-war period, I thought of it as a trans-war topic. But I got so interested in the wartime questions while I was doing my dissertation research that I really ended up focusing on that and having maybe a little epilogue about the post-war in my dissertation. So what I wanted to do for the book was to finish the project, essentially. So I went back to Japan. I did research on the 1964 Olympics. I did research on the 1955 Bandung Conference. I did a bit more research on the UN, although I had started that earlier. And I don't want to say filled out, because I actually just finally wrote that post-war half of the book. It became more of the thematic organization that you see in the book now came later. It was originally sort of a chronological look. So I'd had the dissertation and then this new stuff afterward. And I realized later that the topics were more conducive to kind of bringing the post-war into each section. So that was the major change, is sort of really what I saw as finishing the dissertation.
Okay, great. So let's actually get right into it. And I'll say just kind of a little bit and then open out into some questions from there. So the introduction sets the stage for us to look at or get into the 1920s and to look at the period from the 1920s to the 1960s as a single trans war period. You tell us that after the 1919 Paris Peace Conference and the establishment of the League of Nations, Wilsonianism became the major framework of international relations around the world. In the 1920s, political and intellectual leaders in Japan begin to kind of latch on to the concept of international cooperation. And sort of the nature of Wilsonianism and the way that Japanese approaches to internationalism actually diverge, importantly, from that, becomes an important theme and point of intersection for a bunch of threads later on in the book. So maybe for listeners who may not not be familiar with that concept, can you kind of super briefly describe what do we need to know about Wilsonianism at this point in the conversation in order to understand the significance later on of divergences from that when we start talking about internationalisms in Japan?
Okay, that sounds like a simple question, but it's actually a little bit complex. There's a basic answer and a more complicated answer. The basic answer is ideas of international cooperation that are based on the ideas that Wilson was putting forth at the Paris Peace Conference, ideas such as sovereign equality among nations and free trade and various other modes of cooperating. It has been sort of interpreted away from the specifics of what Wilson said and the discourse that moved up out around that to kind of a general idea of that international cooperation is beneficial and good for the nations involved and for the world as a whole. There's been a lot more theorization in recent decades by political scientists and historians as well on the topic of Wilsonianism and internationalism, starting to kind of question the knee-jerk sense that, oh, Wilsonian cooperation, sovereign nations working together with free trade and human rights, and let's put aside human rights. Sorry, that complicates the question even more. That it's necessarily a good thing, and starting to kind of question the implicit hierarchies of nation and race, as sort of starting to tear those ideas down a little bit, that sort of knee-jerk sense that this is essentially a good thing. So for the purposes of my book, I'm really using the term internationalism, not in a strict kind of dogmatic way, but really to refer to this basic idea that it is in the national interests to cooperate on an international level, and that there are things that nations together can do that one nation by itself can't do.
Great. Thank you so much. And I think the book is really wonderfully clear about the fact also. And I think, you know, it's very explicit about this, that internationalism is not one kind of thing, right, throughout the book. And it's a kind of fluid concept, and it changes over the course of and it kind of pluralizes over the course of the story. So I think that's also a really useful thing for us to keep in mind as listeners who may not be right familiar with the topic. Okay, so after an introduction that sets the stage, we get into the first part of the book. Part one of the book opens in 1933, and it looks at changing Japanese views of multilateral organizations. Now, it opens out into the first chapter into a scene that becomes a kind of flashpoint in a way, and it becomes a really important transformative moment. The Japanese representative to the League of Nations, Matsuoka Yosuke, stands and walks out of the League. This was a protest of the League's decision on the Manchurian dispute between Japan and China, and the book names this as a key moment in the evolution of Japanese foreign policy. So, Jess, can you maybe kind of bring us into this moment and its significance? So, why was this so transformative, and what did this spur in terms of transformations of Japanese approaches to internationalism at this point?
Okay. Well, it was transformative because it was the first step, essentially, of Japan's withdrawal from the League of Nations, its official withdrawal as a nation from the League of Nations. And so it's a major change to Japanese foreign policy. Over the previous 13 years, the Japanese government had initially reluctantly, but fully engaged with the League of Nations. And membership, not just membership in the League, but Japan's position as a member of essentially the equivalent of today's UN Security Council, gave Japan a certain international status, an international position. So withdrawing from the League lost that. It lost a lot of the opportunities for international engagement that, as I said, and your summary pointed out earlier, had become very important, had become, many Japanese diplomats had come to see as very important to Japanese foreign policy and Japan's national interests. So it was transformative because Japan was really losing something. It was losing a position. It was losing a venue for cooperation. And what that meant was that the people who still thought Japan needed to cooperate, and that was most diplomats at this time, they had to find a different way to do it. Right? And they had to find a different way to not just demonstrate Japan's international and regional position and leadership, but also do these kinds of activities that were involved in membership in the League of Nations, things like intellectual cooperation. Maybe we'll talk later about the Society for International Cultural Relations, the Kokusai Bunka Shinkokai. This is an organization that was formed right after Japan quit the League, very explicitly to kind of pick up what had been lost with withdrawing from the League. So it was transformative in that it made people who wanted to continue international engagement try to find new ways to do that. And the question of sort of what ways was it transformed? It's a little bit more complicated than this, but I basically summarized it in the book as a shift from political activities to cultural activities. So even within the League of Nations, the Japanese government said, we're stopping any political activities with the League, any cooperation with the League's political activities, but we're going to continue things like participating on committees on health, on women and children, on the mandates, for instance, labor. So they wanted to continue anything that they saw as separate from the political, but really were withdrawing from just political cooperation. So there was an explicit shift to the cultural there, but also through things like the foundation of the Society for International Cultural Relations and the movement to host the Olympics. And the other half of this kind of two-part transformation was a shift from a global range to a regional one. A lot of the reactions to the League's decision on the Manchurian incident were, well, you know what? The League doesn't understand Asia anyway. How can we trust them to make a decision about Asia when they're just not informed? What we need is an Asian League or some sort of Asia-focused structure for cooperation. So it, from the global scope to the regional scope.
Great. Thank you so much. This actually really beautifully leads us into the next part of the book. So after a chapter that looks at Japan's involvement with the United Nations, and we're not going to have time to really talk substantively about that, but I just want to mark for listeners who are particularly interested in that part of the story that chapter 2 deals with that in really beautiful detail. We move to part 2 of the book. This is a part of the book that traces a shift that you've just described, right? This is a shift toward seemingly kind of, quote, non-political ways of engaging the international community and a shift toward what the book calls and what you've just described as a kind of cultural diplomacy. So this part of the book looks at three examples of attempts to do that. One that we'll talk about in a moment is the establishment and activities of the Society for International Cultural Relations that you've mentioned, and then the two others are an unsuccessful and then a successful effort to host the Olympics in Tokyo in 1938 and 1964, respectively. So let's actually get into it. Chapter 3 looks at the development of non-governmental avenues for diplomacy and the shift toward cultural internationalism. And it focuses in particular on the Society for International Cultural Relations, which was founded in April 1934. So Jess, can you talk kind of briefly just a little bit about this society. What kinds of things did it do, and what do we need to understand about its significance in order to kind of contextualize it within the broader arc of the story that you're telling here?
Okay. Society, I usually refer to it by the Japanese abbreviation KBS. So I'm going to just do that since that's a little bit easier. They had a variety of activities that changed over time. The initial idea was to introduce what they called the cultures of East Asia, or the culture, they didn't pluralize it, the culture of East Asia to a primarily Western audience. And by the culture of East Asia, they meant Japanese culture, and there were things about kimono and Japanese dolls and the like. And so that came in various forms. They engaged in book projects and film projects. They would make a lot of films about various, the day in the life of a Japanese artist, or some sort of other cultural activity or aspect of Japanese culture, society, and distribute these products to various partner countries that they had, mostly in the West. They also had professor exchanges, so they wanted to send Japanese professors abroad and also bring foreign professors to Japan to study, to research. Translation projects, anything that would sort of introduce Japanese culture to a Western audience. After 1938, from 1938, after the escalation of the Sino-Japanese War in 1937, attention of the society really shifted from introducing Eastern culture, i.e. Japanese culture, to a Western audience, and started to focus more on becoming sort of an arm of empire building. One scholar talks about this as the KBS became a subcontractor to the government. I really like that phrase, because they're essentially doing the government's work, right? Some people quit over this shift, but mostly the personnel stayed the same, and they just kind of shifted from trying to build what they referred to as mutual understanding, which really meant getting people to understand Japan and accept their way of thinking about Japan, from mutual understanding to a much more top-down, trying to spread Japanese culture throughout the empire. And this came in Japanese language materials that were sent to China, Southeast Asia, Japanese films. One in particular that came to mind that really emphasized the shift for me in what the KBS was doing was that they had a film called, I forget exactly the name now, but something like Naval Japan, showing it was described as showing the unbeatable power of our Navy. And I was like, well, that's not really so cultural. It's a long stretch from a day in the life of a Japanese artist. So there was a different kind of material certainly being sent to Southeast Asia, but there's also a lot of emphasis on sort of teaching Japanese language and other ways of what they explicitly said was building a cultural co-prosperity sphere. I mean, that phrase, cultural co-prosperity sphere, came a little bit later. That wasn't exactly 1938, more in the early 1940s. But you can see that change happening quite gradually, but clearly from the late 1930s straight through the end of the war.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, this also really nicely leads us into the next chapter and the next example that you take us into. This is chapter 4, which looks at efforts to use sports, or it kind of begins to look at this, and further chapters in the book do this as well. So it begins to look at efforts to use sports in the service of diplomacy, and it focuses on an ultimately unsuccessful effort to host the Olympics in Tokyo in 1938. Now, there are a number of really interesting things going on here in this chapter, and I just kind of want to ask you to talk a little bit about one or two of them. So you talk about this use of the Olympics and sports in the service of diplomacy insofar as it kind of extended and reinforced this turn toward popular cultural diplomacy that we saw in the KBS case that you just described. You mention here something that, again, in the words of the book, and I'm going to put it in the words of the book, is actually really interesting and important, and I think has a lot of relevance to right now and to today. So I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about it. You say the myth that the games were apolitical facilitated their political use. And the chapter talks in part about the politics here as being a kind of fusing of internationalism and the rhetoric of internationalism with rising ultranationalism and ethnocentrism in 1930s Japan. So can you talk a little bit about kind of this intersection for us? How did the myth that the games were apolitical facilitate their political use? And to what extent did that political use start looking more and more like a kind of ethnocentrism and ultranationalism?
Okay. Let me first just make one correction. The games were supposed to be held in 1940. 1938 was the year they were canceled. I just want to
Okay, great. So the unsuccess or the failure was in 1938.
Okay, yeah, exactly.
Great. Thank you for that correction.
So the fusing of internationalism with ultranationalism. Wait, the question was, how did the myth of being apolitical facilitate that political use?
I'm just asking to kind of open this up a little. The chapter seems to talk about, you know, the ways that this rhetoric of apolitical, the apolitical nature of these games really actually helped them be more effective politically.
Yeah, well, the claim that the games are apolitical means that it doesn't matter what your politics are, you can come and play sports with us. And that was useful to Japan at the time because they were being so widely criticized for the invasion of China, right? And so it was a good venue because they could say, you know what? It doesn't matter whether we agree on this question of whether Japan should or should not be in China or whether what we're doing in China is acceptable or not, because the Olympics are above politics, right? That's just politics. The Olympics are above that. And so it's an opportunity for us to all get together in spite of the fact that we have this political disagreement. And the idea from the Japanese side was, well, if we could just get all these foreigners to come to Japan and see what we're really like and see our modern, beautiful capital and understand the Japanese spirit, then they won't criticize us so much. Then they'll really understand that. And here I don't mean to be saying this myself. This is their words, that their perspective was that that foreigners would understand that Japan was the natural and rightful leader of Asia, and they would back off and say, yeah, sure, you should lead China and all these other peoples of Asia, and we're going to stop complaining. That was their wish. And so the myth that the Olympics were apolitical meant that they were getting the opportunity to do that, right? People like the American member of the IOC would say, oh, it doesn't matter that we don't like what they're doing. He said the same thing regarding Nazi Germany, by the way, in 1936. It doesn't matter that we don't like what they're doing. We're not dealing in politics here. If you want to protest, if you want to boycott, go find some other venue to do it in, because sports are above politics. So it even just opened up the opportunity of a country that was doing something that was anathema to the international community could still participate in the international community. The other thing it did was that it emptied out the political content of the Olympics, so you can then fill it in with anything. And what the Japanese filled it in with, very much modeling their effort on the 1936 Berlin Olympics, was this kind of ethnocentric content, which an important aspect of that is that the Olympics are not really apolitical. They have a very strong element of promoting ideals of internationalism and international cooperation. They're also inherently nationalistic, with the national teams facing each other. And, you know, today we see national medal counts and who has more gold, the most gold medals, et cetera, being a part of, for instance, Cold War politics, but still important today. And so what that does is, by having this internationalist content and then allowing the Japanese promoters to fill in their ethnocentric content, it creates this sort of hybrid form of an ethnocentric internationalism.
Thank you so much. So after describing this in Chapter 4, you move us into what was ultimately a successful attempt to host the Olympics in Tokyo. Now, this you describe this next effort to host the Olympics insofar as it built on the experience that you just described, which was ultimately not successful. So you describe in Chapter 5 this Tokyo Olympiad in 1964 as building on the strong connection between sports and diplomacy that had developed in this previous period in the 1930s. So let's talk a little bit about that. For you, what were some of the most important ways that what was happening in the context that you just described importantly shaped the approach to and sort of ultimately what happened in the 1960s at the Tokyo Olympiad that was actually held?
Well, at the most basic level, it was just that idea that we can use this sports event to rebuild connections with the world. And people talked about it a lot that way at the time, that this is so Japan's international debut or something like that, although technically Japan had been involved in various international events, but this was the big splashy one that kind of brought the attention of the world back to Japan, introduced Japan to the world, so to speak. So that on that basic level, there was a very conscious effort to copy what they had done, finish what they had started. People talked about this as the culmination of a bid for the Olympics that had begun in 1932 when they first bid for the Olympics in LA at the LA 1932 LA Games. But importantly, there was also this element of nationalism, which went in kind of a different way insofar as in post-war Japan, nationalism was tainted by the war. The supposedly apolitical nature of the Olympics meant that it was okay to be nationalistic again, right? You're not in danger of being interpreted as being a militarist or of being a right-wing if you're just rooting for your team in the Olympics, right? Because that's a very normal thing to do, to root for your own country, to root for your own country's athletes in the Olympics. So it was sort of a safe space for the sort of rehabilitation of certain Japanese symbols of nationalism. So, for instance, the national flag. Right. What was not officially the national flag, but the Hinomaru, the rising sun flag, is proudly displayed. Right. Because all the countries are displaying their flag. So it's a normal thing to do. The national anthem that was very much tainted and continues today to be tainted by wartime nationalism, also is the national anthem that gets played when Japanese athletes get a gold medal, because every country plays their national anthem when the country gets a gold medal, right? So it became this very normalized thing. So not necessarily creating an ethnocentric internationalism, but certainly providing a space for the rehabilitation of nationalism.
Now, this chapter talks in part about the way that viewing these two Olympic moments together helps us identify elements of Japan's foreign policy that have lasting significance, right? And we've talked a little bit about that. It also talks about something that I think I want to mark because it's going to be particularly of interest to anyone who has an interest in history of technology and in media studies, and that is the importance of satellite television as a technology that actually promotes international relations here. So I think that the chapters really, and all of the chapters are really interesting and careful to focus on the consequences of these case studies that you've been talking about for how internationalism was understood in practice and how it transformed over the course of time. But I also want to just kind of highlight some really cool, interesting details, right? So satellite television and the promotion of international relations. Did you want to talk a little bit about that? Because it seems like a really cool, actually, kind of history of technology part of this story.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that because that's one of my favorite little tidbits as well. And in part because I've been focusing more on transportation infrastructures since I finished this book. So the communications infrastructure also is very interesting to me. This played kind of a two-part role in the promotion of international relations in general, but also Japan's position in the world. One was that it literally connected, right, in a more immediate way, connected Japan to distant places around the world. And they very carefully planned for a satellite to be in position to broadcast the games to the United States and Europe at the time that the Olympics would be held. And the Japanese government helped pay for the United States to launch a satellite so that it would be up there at the right time in the right place. So even though it's American infrastructure, Japan was very deeply involved in getting it put together for this event. So part of it was getting involved in that infrastructure building. And then that the satellite itself and the satellite broadcast of the games, planners imagined, would just make it that much more accessible, right? So more people would get to experience the Japan that they were offering them as a piece of cultural diplomacy, right? So if the idea behind the 1940 games was, oh, bring all these foreigners to Japan, they'll see us, they'll get to know us, they'll love us. Now it was like, well, you don't even have to come to Japan because Japan is coming to your television set and you can see it from the comfort of your living room. So the satellite was important there. Now, of course, the Olympics had already been televised, and a lot of this, because of the time difference, actually was played from tape. But certain parts of it were broadcast live. So the idea of the live broadcast helped get that message out, but it also was itself creating a message. And that message was about Japan as a high-tech nation, right? Even though it was an American satellite, Japanese involvement showed, here we have Japan participating in this very high tech, the latest technology of broadcast, which was these satellites. So being able to see Japan on your television set, but also the knowledge that here, this was Japan kind of helping to create the technology and build the technology of the future, was part of the remaking of Japan's national image that was kind of one of the big keys to cultural diplomacy at this time.
Great, thank you. So as we move from this to the third part of the book, there's actually a lot more description of infrastructure and other ways that Japan was internationalized for the Olympics in Chapter 5 that we won't have a chance to talk about, but I'll just mention for listeners who are particularly interested in this part of the story, that chapter actually talks quite a lot and really interestingly about the ways that construction in and around Tokyo prefaced the Olympics. It talks about about the promotion of judo. It talks about the promotion of sports etiquette. And so there's a lot of really cool aspects of this story about Japan internationalizing itself for the Olympics that readers will find in Chapter 5, that even if we don't have a chance to talk about it in too much detail right now. But let's move on to Part 3. Part 3 of the book looks at notions of Asian regional cooperation in the context of war and its aftermath. And we've already started to talk about this in the our conversation so far, but let's actually get into it because there are a couple of really interesting moments or case studies here that the book opens up into. So I want to kind of move to Chapter 7 for a moment. Chapter 7 looks very closely at the Greater East Asia Conference of 1943, and it talks about the way that this conference helped develop a kind of regionalism here that was at the same time expressed kind of elements of anti-colonialism, anti-Westernism, and it was importantly different from the kind of Wilsonianism that was being promoted at the time. And so this is another reason why I'd like to ask you about this, to kind of follow this thread of a movement away from Wilsonianism that we see in this part of the book. So, Jess, can you talk a little bit about that conference? For you, what's particularly interesting and significant about the Greater East Asia Conference of 1943 and the way that it shaped internationalisms in Japan at that point?
Well, I would emphasize that there were also efforts to maintain a kind of Wilsonianism, even as this is an example of Japan really at the peak of battle against the epitome of the Wilsonian system of the League of Nations and the Allied powers, that Japanese leaders are still trying to use the forms of Wilsonian internationalism, that their Shigemitsu, the foreign minister at the time, even talks about building a league-like structure, right? They are trying to take those ideas of regional cooperation, sovereign equality, open trade, territorial integrity, and use them against the United States and the other allied powers. And in fact, one of the things I do in the chapter is to compare the Atlantic Charter, which is a document signed by the United States and Great Britain, to the document that came out of this conference, the Greater East Asian Declaration. And really, point by point, they're saying the same things. Mm-hmm. However, the Greater East Asian Conference is quite clearly an effort to just get other Asian countries to help Japan in its war effort. Part of that comes from the joint planning of the event. So people like Prime Minister Tojo were really thinking about this as a way to get the nations of Southeast Asia and China on board with Japan's war effort, while Foreign Minister Shigemitsu is really thinking about it as the beginnings of a post-war diplomacy and trying to build some sort of league-like structure, some sort of Wilsonian structure for international relations. So they have almost opposite goals in the conference. So it really ends up being, like the 1940 Olympics, bringing together the opposites of internationalism and ethnocentrism, bringing together the apparent opposites of militarism and aggressive imperialism with international cooperation.
Great, thank you. Now, the next chapter looks at another really, really interesting moment and another really interesting conference that also kind of expands some of these concerns and moves us forward in the story. This is the Asian-African Conference held in Bandung, Indonesia in April 1955. Now, you talk about this conference as being particularly significant as a kind of first step in establishing Japanese leadership of this kind of regional network, and in the words of the book, redeploying many of the ideas and practices of Japan's wartime policies toward Asia. There's really interesting things that are happening at this conference. You talk about the fact that the Japanese delegation was actually relatively quiet in their presence at the conference. You talk about the fact that the delegation is presenting a kind of new Japan at this conference. So there's a lot of really cool stuff that we could talk about here, but what I'd like to just ask you is what you think in this is most kind of interesting and significant about this Bandung conference. Insofar as it helps us understand the larger points and the larger goals that the book has in terms of telling its story about internationalism.
I guess in terms of there's a lot about the Bandung conference that I find most interesting. So that's a hard question to answer. But in terms of the goals of the book, probably the most important element is the similarities between the 1943 Greater East Asia Conference and the 1955 Bandung Conference, two conferences that have almost opposite goals, but in a way very similar goals insofar as they both did have that anti-colonial, anti-Western emphasis. But here, you know, really Japan is in the opposite position. They almost weren't invited to the Bandung Conference. Several of the planning countries were kind of like, wait a minute, how are we going to invite this formal colonial power to our anti-colonial conference? That doesn't make sense, but others prevailed based on the idea that they really needed the Japanese economy for their own rebuilding and post-colonial goals. And so ultimately Japan was invited, but it was not the one calling the shots as it had been in 1943. In 1943, the Japanese decided everything. They wrote the so-called joint declaration themselves. In 1955, they, as you pointed out, barely said a word in the sort of main conference and were just more active in cultural activities and economic activities. There were two subcommittees, kind of the cultural subcommittee and the economic subcommittee, and the Japanese were more active there. But in the main political meetings, the sort of chief delegates meetings, I found maybe two sentences that the Japanese delegate uttered the entire time. And one of them was like, yeah, I agree with my colleague who just spoke. You know, they were really not saying a lot. So it was sort of one important difference was this sheepish position. But at the same time, even while they were in this very different position, they were saying a lot of the same things. In his speech to the chief delegates, meeting, a prepared speech for which an English translation was passed around, although he spoke in Japanese. The Japanese delegate even used the phrase co-prosperity, although it was translated differently in the English version. He used that same kyoe that the co-prosperity sphere has in Japanese. So the word is the same in Japanese. So here he is at this post-colonial, anti-colonial conference calling for co-prosperity in Asia. So he's saying a lot of the same things that were said, using a lot of the same ideas that were voiced in 1943. Of course, to a different end, not looking for cooperation in war, but very much looking to rebuild the bridges that had been burned by the war, by Japanese aggression in these countries, by promoting economic cooperation and kind of various cultural activities that would achieve the same kinds of goals that planners of the Olympics had talked about, you know, develop understanding of Japan, right? If we can have them read up about Japanese culture, that they will no longer think of us in this sort of, as this militaristic aggressive country, but instead they'll think of us as a country with advanced technological capabilities, a country that can help us, with our development goals, as a model for development, as a teacher or an aid in development. And so in that way, you know, you talked about this phrase, New Japan, and that's something that's all over the Japanese writings on this conference, that they just really want to introduce a new Japan. They want to get rid of these old ideas and really create something new. But the funny thing is that in trying to create this new thing, they do kind of dust off a lot of the old wartime ideas. They even take I forget exactly who does this. One of the people involved in the conference kind of talks about it in terms of another step in a long process of promoting racial equality, and they can bring it back to the Paris Peace Conference, saying, you know, Japan proposed a racial equality clause in the League of Nations Charter, and we were shot down at that point. And ever since, you know, kind of forgetting that there was a whole war in between, ever since we've been trying to promote racial equality. And so that rhetoric from before and also from during the war getting kind of brought back out in this new context to create a supposedly new Japan, which in many ways is a lot like the old Japan.
So as we move toward the conclusion of our conversation, we also move toward the end of the book. There's an epilogue in the book that does a lot of really interesting, thoughtful work. But one of the things in particular that it discusses is what I'd like to kind of ask you to talk a little bit about. So the epilogue talks a little bit about the ways that all of this help us think about and maybe understand the upcoming 2020 Summer Olympic and Paralympic Games to be held in Tokyo. So Jess, as a way of kind of bringing this to a close, could you talk a little bit about that? How does this story help or inform how we think about the upcoming Olympic Games and Paralympic Games in Tokyo?
Well, one important aspect is the way that sports have continued to be part of the sort of toolbox of Japanese diplomacy. This is not the first time we're seeing it again since 1964. I mean, there have been a few Olympic Games, Winter Olympics in Japan, but where I really saw it most clearly before this was in the World Cup held jointly in Korea and Japan. That actually happened while I was doing my dissertation research, and I happened to be researching the 1940 Olympics chapter while I was reading the newspaper articles about the joint World Cup with Korea. And it was kind of funny how similar the stuff I was reading in the archives during the day was to the stuff I was reading in the newspaper when I got home at night. A lot of the same, like, oh, people will get to know us, you know, then they'll understand. We'll understand each other. Mutual understanding will lead to world peace and all this. And I thought, well, okay, they're still trying. So one element is to just see that in the long trajectory, but also to kind of understand why do countries want to host the Olympics? There's been a lot of question along those lines lately, because there've been a lot of studies about how tough this is on cities, how economically painful it can be, much in great contrast to the sort of economic boost that people talk about. So why does a country want to host the, why does a city want to host the Olympics? And part of it has to do with this international image that's created. Another thing that really struck me in thinking about the 2020 Olympics was that even as it's imagined as this interconnection between national interests and international goals, the content of that was very different. So it's a very different Japan coming to the 2020 Games, bidding for the 2020 Games, than the one that bid for either the 1940 or the 1964 Games. So both of those were Japan trying to show how strong it was, whether militarily in the 1930s or economically and technologically in the 1960s, to taking a different international position. It was Japan really positioning itself against China, the rising power in Asia, and trying to say, look, we are the mature country. Tokyo is a mature city. We have things to offer and a model to present to other mature cities. I mean, the word mature really struck me in their materials. We're not up and coming, they seem to be saying, but we have figured everything out and we have the wisdom to share with the world. So it was a very different attitude coming into it, but at the same time, a lot of the same activities. So for instance, I talked in chapter five about the sewer system being built, in part because people were embarrassed about the possibility that foreigners would come to Tokyo and it would literally stink. So they said, well, we have to build sewers. Well, in the run-up to the 2020 Games, or actually as soon as the Games were awarded to Tokyo, people started saying, hey, you know, we built these sewers about 50 years ago, and it's really time for an upgrade. So, you know, not just the sewers, but a lot of different aspects of Tokyo infrastructure kind of started getting connected to the Olympic Games in very much the same way as had happened in 1964 and in 1940 as well, although we haven't talked about that. That there's this very local aspect of the politics of the Olympics. So on the one level, it's this sort of international relations, big picture, but on the other level, it's like as nitty gritty as you can get in talking about the sewer system. Mm-hmm.
So now that we are at the conclusion of the conversation, there's of course a bunch of stuff that we could have talked about, right, that we didn't have time for. There's a ton more stuff discussed related to all the things that we talked about in the chapters. But given that, is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
I don't think there's anything in particular that I want to mention other than, well, when we were talking before, you said something about the cover of the book. And I will say that I'm very proud of the cover of the book because I colored those flags myself. This is
really
from a black and white picture that I found. And it took me actually hours of playing with it on my computer. And I think it came out pretty nice.
It does look great.
Thank you.
So now that the book is out and it does have a fabulous cover, so I'm glad that you mentioned that. What is next for you? What are you working on now? What's what kind of work is currently inspiring you?
Well, I mentioned transportation infrastructure. Right now I'm working on a cultural history of Japan's first bullet train, which opened between Tokyo and Osaka in 1964, actually just a few days before the opening ceremonies of the Olympics, which is actually what got me interested in this topic. In researching the Olympics, I kept seeing people talking about the bullet train and they were so excited. And I said, you know, this is the jet age. Why are you excited about a train? And I really wanted to know. So I started looking into that. And, you know, the bullet train is often called a symbol of modern Japan. So I said, well, if it's a symbol, what does it signify? And so the book I'm working on now is an effort to answer that question in terms of international relations. In part, I'm not completely moving away from international relations, but I'm thinking about how the bullet train affects Japan's relations, not only with the West, where there's starting to be some trade tensions emerging, but also with other countries, developing countries especially, who they might be able to help with train technology and kind of do that sort of technological diplomacy that we saw happening a little bit in the Bandung conference. So partly in terms of international relations along those lines, but also in terms of the social construction of space. How does the bullet train change the way people understand the social space of their city, the Tokaido region, their nation as a whole, and also in that getting at questions of identity on the level of not just the individual, but also cities and the nation as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds great, too. So thank you so much for taking time away from that to talk with me about this project.
My pleasure.
Congratulations on the book, Jess, and thanks so much again for making time. It's really been a pleasure.
Pleasure is all mine. Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.